Some days I'm Santa Claus, and some days I'm the executioner. Would you like to see him blow some stuff up?
Yeah. Larry Schaefer has lived in deposit his whole life, and he's a supporter of hydrofracking in New York. It fits nicely with what he's done all his life. His family business includes bluestone quarries, a sawmill, and a logging company. Schaefer's a natural resource exploiter and proud of it.
The noise is here. We're here. We've been here. The loggers are here. The sawmills run. The quarries blow things up, and the crushers crush, and the trucks run, and people have to bang on things and fix things and do things. That's the way it is on a farm. That's the way it is in the woods. That's the way it is in the quarry, and that's the way it is here at the mill.
It's a sunny morning in July. Sitting in an SUV in the middle of this piece of his family empire, Schaefer watches three of his employees push long boards through a saw. 10-foot-tall log stacks surround them, and forklifts zip back and forth. Some quick background before we go any further. First, if you're not sure what the Marcellus Shale is, it's a gas-rich rock formation that sits thousands of feet under Pennsylvania, New York, West Virginia, and Ohio. Last year, the U.S. Geological Survey estimated that the Marcellus holds 84 trillion cubic feet of recoverable natural gas. The Department of Energy expects that the Marcellus will soon be the most productive shale formation in the gas-rich United States. The method used to coax gas out of the Marcellus and other shale formations is high-volume, slick-water hydraulic fracturing using horizontal drilling. Millions of gallons of water-based fluids are pumped into the rock to open it up so the gas can flow. It has become a controversial process, and Larry Schaefer hopes that before the end of the year, it will come to deposit.
Everyone is going to win. The only way we wouldn't win is if this is a horrible big mistake and we've been tricked and that they're going to ruin our water and they're going to ruin our land. That would be the hoax. And I would think that by now, someone would certainly have exposed that in fine form and been able to prove it. Not just all these anti-saner, no, 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 no. You know, and they say no, no to me cutting these trees. They say no, no to me harvesting this rock out of here.
Schaefer's a short guy with a mustache. When we met, I learned how second-growth hardwood or a slab of stone might feel around him if they had feelings. He quickly sized me up and seemed to figure out how he could turn a profit off the exchange. From Schaefer's sawmill, we traveled a few miles into the hills. On the road above the river valley, thick woods threw a shade over the blacktop.
They cut this land all off. It was all evergreens, and they floated them down the river before that. That's what my grandfather Alberta did on the Alberta side. He floated stuff down the river, and they cleared these hills. I mean, they cleared them.
As we drive, Schaefer points out places to stack fresh-cut lumber and the bluestone quarries tucked away in the woods. He laments the areas that are off-limits to logging and celebrates the light impact of the Millennium Gas Pipeline as it snakes through the hills outside deposit. Taking a tour guided by Schaefer is what a conservationist nightmare might look like.
I stripped this in the 1970s when I got out of school. I'd rather do that than go to college. So I stripped that quarry there, and it's already grown up. The trees are 10 inches through since the 1970s.
Greedy doesn't seem like the right word for Schaefer. At least he doesn't flaunt his wealth. He's wearing jeans and a t-shirt and drives a Land Cruiser on this trip. He says hunting is his only hobby. I didn't ask, but long, exotic vacations don't seem like his thing. Instead, Schaefer comes across as a businessman who just likes what he does.
I'd be a damn fool if I didn't use the stone quarry. I'd be a damn fool if I didn't cut the timber that grows on my land, put it through my sawmill. I'd be a damn fool if I didn't milk the cows that I raise and take the beef from that steer that is so fine and take those vegetables off that land. I live from this land. I don't live from some public.
I guess it's the same community it was 200 years ago, really, basically, 1812.
Richard Axtell runs an antique shop in Deposit's oldest building, next to the Delaware River in the village center.
Really, the same industries are here as were then, timber and stone.
The red two-story relic that includes his shop was first opened as a tavern in 1799.
This next room is the tap room. This is where the barrels were tapped and where whiskey was distributed.
Axtell is also the town's historian, and he looks the part. He's 65 with graying hair and spectacles. Axtell doesn't move fast and has a gentle demeanor. The house's wooden floors creak as he slowly makes his way through rooms filled with old brass tools and framed landscapes. Axtell says Deposit and the West Branch of the Delaware River were bustling back in the 19th century.
Actually, when they were traveling from this area, they would be waiting for rafts to be built, maybe, in the wintertime, and they would ride the spring freshets of the river down to Philadelphia. So,
since its early days, Deposit has relied on its connection to New York City. What is now Highway 17 was old Route 17, and before that it was a Native American trail, and it connected western New York with New York City back then, too.
All these hills you see around here are solid rock. They are really beautiful stone. City walks, sidewalks in New York are from Deposit. In fact, we have photographs in the Historical Society of huge slabs of stone going by rail down to the city.
Axtell sees natural gas extraction as a logical next step for Deposit.
I think it's a great opportunity, really, for our area to take advantage of a natural resource that is underneath us. It won't change the beauty of the hills and everything else.
A picture of a logger holding an axe serves as the village welcome sign. Below the logger is the phrase, "Where nature blesses, man progresses." And through its history, that's been a pretty good slogan for this town. But the dairy industry, which dominated in the first half of the 20th century, has been decimated. There used to be 86 dairy farms here. Now there's no more than 6, according to Axtell. When New York City created a reservoir to the north of Deposit in the 60s, the expansion of the logging industry was curtailed. And some would like to see the town turn a corner, instead of simply cashing in on the next natural resource boom.
This is Lake Oquaga. Surrounded by lovely private lake homes. We have Scott's here, and then you
Melissa
can see
Bishop
the chestnut
is a transplant from Long Island, a retiree who's not shy about her opinions. She's the kind of lady who spends her afternoon at the courthouse to see what's going on and clears her mind with letters to the town board or local paper. With a little effort, Bishop believes that Deposit's blue ribbon trout streams and cool air could be made into valuable attractions.
If you walk down there, I'm going to try and drive us down there. But it's a beautiful spring-fed lake up on top of a mountain, about 100 feet deep, constantly, you know, fed by spring, so it's a little chilly.
Up here, the stone crushers and chainsaws and forklifts of Larry Schaefer's Deposit are replaced by the sound of water slapping against a wooden dock and, well, a lot of silence. This is the Deposit that Melissa Bishop wants. And she believes the natural gas industry would ruin it forever.
I'm close the door behind you.
At the Cornerstone Cafe, just outside the village, there's still a late breakfast crowd on this Friday morning. Bishop says she has to speak softly. Drilling is pretty popular here.
My feeling is, and I feel this very strongly, that if the drilling comes, all the ancillary activity, never mind just the drilling, the trucks, the noise, the sheer destructive nature of these gas wells would really destroy a lot of everything that I love about this area. And I don't think that's disputable.
Her reasons for opposing fracking are the same that you hear from a lot of opponents. She's worried about its effect on water sources. Methane and other contaminants have been found in drinking water near drilling sites in Pennsylvania. The disposal of the salty, contaminated water that comes back up after wells drilled can easily ruin a water source. And Bishop doesn't trust gas companies to take responsibility for any accidents that happen.
It's criminal, immoral, whatever word you want to use. I think they have shown in Pennsylvania they cannot be trusted, ever, my opinion. Ever to tell the truth or to do the right thing.
The Pennsylvania border is just 5 miles south of Deposit. For Bishop and a lot of other drilling opponents, Pennsylvania is the ultimate example of what fracking does to a place. When drilling supporter Larry Schaefer stands on top of one of his quarries, he sees a boomtown across the border. When Bishop looks at the same scene, she sees something very different.
And I think we've seen the consequences. In terms of polluted water, explosions. I mean, it seems like every day I read about another compressor exploding or a horrible accident or a spill or something.
And, what exactly have the 8,000 or so active natural gas wells brought to Pennsylvania? The answer to that depends on who you ask.
You know, we gave it up and we gave it to Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania's capitalizing on it.
Larry Schaefer.
When I was a kid, we used to laugh at the conditions of Pennsylvania across the border. It was a real Appalachia. Well, now that's New York.
On the way to one of his quarries, I asked Schaefer about a recent peer-reviewed study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The industry has consistently argued that there's just too much rock between where the gas is found and drinking water supplies closer to the surface for any contamination to occur. But the researchers in this study found evidence of natural pathways that can span the thousands of feet of rock. Schaefer's not read the report, and he probably won't. The exposed rock walls at his bluestone quarry are evidence enough for him.
All right, we're a couple hundred feet in the ground through this rock. Am I scared about drilling 5,000 feet down in the ground and shaking up a little bit of shale and letting the gas come out? Come on. After you see this here, if all these antis could come here and see how this works and how natural resource extraction really is, it wouldn't bother them either. I mean, I'm right in the middle of this thing, have been all my life, and it don't scare me.
In a moment, we're going to look at how a range of circumstances put this small southern tier town in the middle of the fracking debate in New York.
A pharmacy. We have a lovely gift shop that's really very nice.
As Melissa Bishop continues her tour, Deposit looks like any of the small towns in this part of New York.
We have excellent hairdressers, about four of them. We have a nail salon over here.
Of all the towns in the five counties of New York's southern tier likely to see fracking first, why focus on Deposit? For one thing, it sits on a sweet spot on the gas-rich Marcellus Shale. It's also representative of the communities that would be affected by hydrofracking. It's mostly woods and dairy farms. It's surrounded by water with the Delaware River running through it, the Cannonsville Reservoir, and Oquaga Lake on either side. The area's history and its proximity to the Millennium Pipeline, which could take gas from here to New York City, means it's a place where everything lines up just right. Also, the ball began rolling in 2008. Back then, the town's most powerful official saved his farm by signing a lease with a gas company.
When you go back, you go out 17 and you look up on the bank there. There'll be a sign that's up on there, 1,100 acres for sale.
That's Dewey Decker. He's a supervisor of the town of Sanford, which includes half the village of Deposit.
Probably I should go take it down myself. And if we didn't get a gas lease, I wouldn't have a farm now.
We were going to sell all the land before the gas
lease? We were selling the whole farm. Because we couldn't afford to keep it. The boys decided that they couldn't farm it, and we just weren't going to be able to survive.
In 2008, Decker, a retired dairy farmer, turned a group of local landowners into the Deposit Coalition.
I believe the first meeting was at the theater here in Deposit. And Chesapeake and Norse Energy had already gone through here and was signing people up. I think they started like at $10, then they went up to like $25, and I think some of them got 50, and they were excited.
They eventually pooled 50,000 acres in and around Deposit and put them up for lease, and gas companies fought over those leases.
We got the gas lease with XTO. We were very fortunate to do that. It was a blessing to us personally. It was a blessing to an awful lot of them.
Thanks to that lease, Decker didn't have to sell his land. His coalition signed it in May 2008. 50,000 acres, $2,411 an acre. That's $120 million in upfront money for about 400 landowners. The lease is with the country's top natural gas producer, XTO Energy. And it changed the fracking debate in New York. At the time, fracking was in full swing just over the border in Pennsylvania. In June of 2008, the price for 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas was over $10, five times what it is today. This was before fracking started to get some bad press. before methane migration caused a water well to explode in Dimmock, Pennsylvania, before a deluge of lawsuits against frackers in Dimmock and elsewhere cast doubt on the method's safety, and before the 2010 release of the anti-fracking documentary Gasland. There wasn't much to stop companies from drilling more wells. The drillers were ready to simply stroll across the border back then.
After we signed, they came here. They put stakes. They were building equipment to come here to drill.
Right today, on the drilling phase, there are probably upwards of a dozen different companies working here.
That's Cabot Oil and Gas spokesman George Stark at a drilling site in Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania. Huge generators power the hilltop operation. On one side, the well pad is ringed by white trailers that serve as offices and living quarters. A view of forests, a few farmhouses, and green pastures ring the other side.
We're set to drill about 60 wells. Now, again, 60 wells would not necessarily mean 60 pad sites either. It would mean much less because you're drilling maybe 4 to a pad site.
Overall, despite low natural gas prices, production in Susquehanna County has been on the rise since January of 2011. The scene at this site and in the towns around it can be found across Pennsylvania. Statewide, companies reported a 61% increase in production during the past year. Who knows how much gas would be coming out of the Marcellus if New York had allowed drilling back in 2008. Former Gannett reporter Tom Wilbur says we came very close to finding out.
In 2008, shale gas development looked imminent. The deposit deal had just come down. Everybody was paying attention. There was a lot of money on the table. And this created a lot of headlines, a lot of media coverage. People were talking.
Back then, there was much less known about the hazards of hydrofracking. Wilbur wrote a book called Under the Surface about the industry's history in the Marcellus Shale that was published this year by Cornell University Press. Wilbur says it wasn't the environmental groups who stopped fracking in 2008.
Before the whole anti-fracking movement, there was this movement among townsfolks, landowners, emergency responders, local government officials that put the brakes on this.
In public meetings in small upstate towns like Deposit and Shenango and Norwich, local officials and landowners voiced their concerns to officials from the Department of Environmental Conservation.
The typical answer from the DEC, and I covered several of these meetings back in 2008, was don't worry about it. There's no problem. We've been doing natural gas development forever. There's never been a problem. Don't worry about it. And the municipal people were saying, well, what about emergency response plans? What about zoning? What about traffic? What about wastewater disposal? All these things. And the DEC wasn't giving the answers.
Back then, the idea of putting a hold on hydrofracking had widespread support. The DEC agreed that it needed to update its drilling regulations in 2008. A draft environmental impact statement on hydrofracking, the now famous ESGEIS, was released in 2009. That document has received withering criticism from environmentalists and attracted tens of thousands of public comments. Near the end of his term in 2010, then-New York Governor David Paterson issued an executive order that put hydrofracking on hold until the next summer. That moratorium has lasted until now.
People didn't expect it to turn into a two-year, three-year, four-year, certainly not a four-year process. And people became unhappy with it. Some people, the landowners in particular, who were very eager to lease their land, became unhappy with it after about a year. It didn't become a matter of concern among the big institutional environmental groups, I would say, until 2009 to 2010. And I think it really got into everybody's radar screen with Josh Fox's movie, Gasland. That was in the summer of 2010.
I was starting to compile a list of things that happened at Dimmock. Water trouble, health problems, hazardous explosive conditions inside the house, destruction of land, lack of confidence in state regulatory commissions, a feeling of having been deceived, a feeling of powerlessness, dead or sick animals.
The documentary Gasland has done more than any single study, speech, or news report to sway people against hydrofracking. Grassroots organizers in New York mail out copies of the DVD to influence landowners. The natural gas industry has waged a campaign to discredit the film, including a documentary of their own called Truthland.
That film said all these problems were caused by natural gas. You see, we felt blessed just a little while ago when they found natural gas on our property. We could have as many as 10 wells, they said. But this little movie...
Truthland was widely panned as blatant industry propaganda, and it didn't have anything to compare with the image from Gasland of a homeowner lighting his tap water on fire.
Whoa.
It's kind of amazing, despite all the concerns about hydrofracking dramatized in Gasland and written up by investigative reporters and chronicled by academics, New York is still the only place to block hydrofracking. So far, regulations have been left to the states, and from California to South Dakota to Ohio, fracking has been welcomed wherever companies could turn a profit. Wilbur says the first reason why New York is held out is Pennsylvania, where fracking found a more natural home.
Mineral extraction has long been a central part, or a significant part, at least, of the Pennsylvania economy. You have the Drake oil fields from the 1800s. There was a huge boom and led to the modern-day petroleum industry. You have the coal mining, obviously, the anthracite coal mines that were in northern Pennsylvania, a huge part of the Industrial Revolution all the way up through the early, mid-1900s. You have quarrying. So you have this legacy in Pennsylvania of mineral extraction.
That history hasn't tried to make its way from Pennsylvania into New York to this degree until now.
New York hasn't traditionally had a lot of mineral extraction, and they have a different political culture about it. Land preservation has always been an important political driver in New York State, and you have the Catskills, you have the Finger Lakes, you have the Adirondacks. So it's more foreign to New Yorkers.
Mike Bernhardt and his wife, Mary Jo Long, live in Afton, a small rural town 30 miles north of Deposit. Their house is set back off the road, gardens, woods, and a few chickens surround their old farmhouse. We sat by a pond on their property one afternoon in July. Bernhardt has been working to keep fracking out of New York for almost 5 years. He and his wife are two of the more visible members of the grassroots movement that has flourished in small towns upstate. And he's frustrated that letting the industry in is still a possibility.
You said you were so tired of it. Why are you tired of it?
Because it's been 5 years. Because it was today, you know, my grandkids were out here swimming in the pond and I wasn't here. Because there's so much going on and so much we have to respond to all the time. You know, we all wish, we that are fighting this, all wish we didn't have to fight it. We wish we could go back to a time when our own lives or lifestyles were not so much at stake, you know. I mean, 5 years ago they were dropping bombs on people in Iraq. But we could ignore that because there were no bombs here. Now we're starting to feel this is a bomb. This is a huge bomb bursting over our head. And so it's hard to stop from working at it all the time.
Long joined the Afton Town Board 6 years ago. She was at those early hydrofracking meetings with other municipal officials. Even then, Long didn't believe what she was hearing from industry spokesmen.
They had us at circular tables. You know, we weren't in rows. And so somebody from up at the podium made that statement, oh, there's never been a documented instance of interfering with water. And I, you know, I turned to all the guys, because they were all guys, sitting at my table, and I said, do you believe that? And they all said, no, because they knew about Brookfield. We all knew, you know, but it's how they defined it, you know.
The year before, in 2007, a driller in the central New York town of North Brookfield was drilling a traditional vertical well. The drill bit got stuck hundreds of feet below ground. To free it up, they pumped compressed air into the well. That air made its way into drinking water wells a half mile away, turning some into 15-foot-tall geysers. But, Long says, because it didn't happen at the moment when shale was being hydraulically fractured, the industry was able to say fracking has never affected water.
That didn't count. And it turns out all the instances that various people knew of interference with water didn't count in that, you know, fact that you know, the pro-gas industry wanted to proclaim.
It didn't take a lot of convincing for Long and Bernhardt to decide that a full ban on fracking was the only way to go.
One of the early events was they brought in two people from Colorado and one from Wyoming.
Summer of 09.
And basically they talked about all the problems and said, you can't stop it, but, you know, you need to get your ducks in order so that you can negotiate the best agreement and you can demand, you know, as much protection as you can, because if you don't, they'll just roll over you. And so people in that audience said, well, why are you saying we can't stop it, you know?
Maybe we're arrogant.
Yeah, I mean, some people still think that, oh, you have to kind of go the regulatory route. You just want to minimize the parts per million that they will allow in pollution. But there were enough people saying, well, wait a minute, you know.
We want to stop
it. We want to stop it. No, we don't want this.
They don't have to be convinced of how many parts per million do harm or what kind of asthma rates there are in Colorado. They just have a revulsion about industrial processes in their landscape.
And so Bernhard has spent the years since then convincing people that this industry won't be good for them. It began with meetings, groups like his and New York Residents Against Drilling, New Yorkers Against Fracking, and many more at the town level brought in speakers from regions already living with the industry. At the same time, there was a deliberate effort to slow down the state's environmental review process, which began in 2009. That meant the Department of Environmental Conservation was forced to read and respond to tens of thousands of written comments. Environmental groups pressured the DEC into holding a series of public hearings across the state. But all indications from Governor Andrew Cuomo and the DEC are that fracking will eventually move forward. So some groups have started to plan more direct actions, like this rally in Albany, organized by New Yorkers Against Fracking.
Governor, if you want to run for president, having water contamination in New York State with some of the best water quality in the
country, Governor Cuomo and the Department of Environmental Conservation could stop fracking in New York. The New York State Legislature could also pass a law against it. And some local governments have chosen to take quite a bit of control over drilling. Two court cases, one in Dryden and one in Middlefield, have upheld the local power to prohibit hydrofracking. So far, more than 100 towns in New York have either banned or placed temporary holds on fracking. At the General Clinton Canoe Regatta in Bainbridge, Bernhard manned an anti-fracking booth behind the carousel right next to the campaign booth of a local politician. Bernhard has turned his attention towards landowners who might want drilling.
Would you get those folders, those manila envelopes, the neighbor-to-neighbor manila envelopes? I got a couple.
He and his group, Sea Dog, send out information on testing water wells and how to get out of an unwanted gas lease. He usually throws in a Gasland DVD, anything that might make them think twice about going into business with a gas company.
Don't deal with them at all. Don't deal with them at all. Don't sign a lease. You're in business with that company. This is something that people aren't going to understand until accidents start happening. And then they're going to see that if you live uphill from me and the stuff flowed down your hill into my stream, I'm suing you. You went into business with these people.
The canoe regatta was in May, at a time when the anti-fracking groups felt like they were winning. Local bans were spreading across upstate. Governor Cuomo hadn't said much about when or if fracking would be allowed in the state.
Once they buy the pipeline right of way,
when I met Bernhard and Long again in July, it was after reports on Cuomo's plans to go ahead with limited fracking. The Afton Town Board had just passed a resolution in favor of the DEC's authority over drilling. 30 or so town boards in areas where drilling is likely to occur have passed the same resolution. It's intended as a signal to the governor and industry that fracking would be welcome in the towns that pass it. On the Afton Town Board, Long was the only vote against the resolution.
They didn't even really want to discuss it. I tried to have discussions, and they really just wanted to have a vote.
Before voting, the board got the opinion of the town's attorney. Long had his letter to the board, which advised against passing the resolution.
So what Jim Downey said, adopting the resolution is contrary to my recommendation. Actually, his recommendation said the board do nothing if it's the collective opinion not to exercise its limited authority. Moratoriums, he thinks, are legal he said, either exercise your Dryden and Middlefield authority or do nothing. Do nothing does means do not adopt canned resolutions submitted by either side of the issue, especially without affording your constituents the prior opportunity to offer comment at public hearing.
How often does the town board go against the town attorney's recommendation?
Never.
I cannot remember another time. I can't. In 6 years.
Bernhard says it's people like Dewey Decker and Larry Schaefer in Deposit, those who support fracking and stand to benefit the most, who are drumming up support for resolutions like this one. But Bernhard has a very different view than Schaefer's on this area's natural resource extraction history.
So this is true. I mean, I agree with the guy that this is the way it's always been. But that's what keeps us poor. That's what makes poverty, is being the place where they take the oil, where they take the coal, where they take the gas, or they take the wood, and nothing happens with that wood. It's just exported. And the gas.
But the people who stand to benefit the most if fracking is allowed also see the issue as a struggle to preserve their way of life. Dewey Decker has received a lot of criticism for serving as a town supervisor while also having a gas lease. But Decker has watched for the last 50 years as outsiders have chipped away at his livelihood.
I've been lived in this valley really my whole life. I think around 61, 62, Route 17 went through. It took out three barns, 107 acres, and our house and our machinery business. It went right straight through the middle of all of our property. And then I believe it was the following year that the Cannonsville Dam went in.
The Cannonsville Dam created the last of New York City's upstate reservoirs. It was finished in 1967, and the reservoir is just a five-mile drive out of Deposit on Route 10.
That took out all the farms up to, really, from Deposit all the way up to Walton. And there was a lot of good dairy farms up through there. Consequently, we ended up going out of the machinery business.
That reservoir created a lot of bitterness here. Almost 1,000 people were displaced. Buried underneath the 95 billion gallons of drinking water are the remains of five communities.
We also lost the milk market because we sent our milk to Queens Farms, and they had their milk creamery. Their milk plant was right there in Cannonsville.
Before Decker and the Deposit Coalition signed with XTO Energy in 2008, he went across the border to Soroka, Pennsylvania. A group of landowners there were negotiating to lease their mineral rights with Chesapeake Energy for $750 an acre. He recruited the woman who helped negotiate that lease to come up to Deposit.
My name is Jackie Root. I live in Lawrenceville, Pennsylvania. Been a farmer for the last 35 years, I guess, since I married my husband. We have a business called R&R Energy Consulting. It's a landowner consulting business.
Root helps landowners negotiate with gas companies. She did her first deal in Pennsylvania 6 or 7 years ago. Root is self-taught, started research in the oil and gas industry after a landman came to her house 10 years ago, offering her a lease for $2 an acre. We met at a coffee shop in Owego, shortly before a meeting with a group of local landowners. She doesn't look like someone who negotiates $100 million deals. She's short and middle-aged, wearing a sweatshirt and jeans, and with a quick, disarming laugh from the first handshake. But after a while, her tirelessness starts to come through.
Landowners, you know, it's a tough thing to know how far you can push. You're getting a well on your property, but you really don't want it right here. You don't want it so that it's blocking that view. But you're afraid that if you ask for changes, that you'll drive them away. And so having somebody that understands what's reasonable and can tell them where they can push the company is real important.
Ultimately, for Root and the landowners that she represents, this comes down to business. If she feels like the company isn't paying enough, she'll say no. If she feels like the company isn't accepting reasonable requests for where the wells go, she'll say no. The same is true for landowners like Decker. This is a business negotiation. So Decker sees this hiatus by the state, driven by the anti-fracking movement centered far away in places like Ithaca and New York City, as just more infringements on his right to do business.
I believe when dealing with the gas companies, my father always said that if you want to continue business with somebody, you want that business to survive. I've seen places where I used to do all my business to so-and-so down the road before they went out of business. The point I'm making is, if you want to continue to do business, you want that business to survive.
Jackie Root says it's standard now for leases to prohibit open wastewater ponds like the ones that have caused problems in Pennsylvania. She says leases also should have a clause that covers the landowner against lawsuits. And she acknowledges the environmental risks, but gets her information from sources besides the documentary Gasland.
It's an industrial process, but for farmers who are the true environmentalists, we live it. We walk the walk. For us, it's important to know what the real risks are, and the garbage that Josh Fox and other people like him are spewing, that clouds the real issues.
4 years into the debate, New Yorkers are pretty set in their views on fracking. Upstaters tend to oppose it. Downstaters support it. Statewide, it's pretty close to an even split. The numbers in the monthly Siena College poll on this topic don't move much. And that makes some, like Dewey Decker, wonder what else needs to be learned before they just start permitting it.
Are you starting to feel frustrated about how long it's taken?
Yes. The frustration is the reasoning for it. You've heard me keep saying negotiating. For example, I went to Trenton to speak in favor. That was to do with the Delaware River Basin. And unfortunately, there was only two people that was down there that was for it. And when I get up to express my opinion, the anti-people were yelling at to speak up and everything. And I guess I felt like saying, you know, if you would listen, maybe you could understand the other side of this issue. And when I say this, I don't want to appear like I'm just hammering on regulation, because I believe in a lot of regulations. It's just that we got to create a balance.
For an example of what out-of-control regulations can do, Decker points to Walton and New York City's watershed. It started with a 1905 law that gave New York City the right to come upstate for its water. The challenges of maintaining that supply ballooned after Congress passed the Clean Drinking Water Act. That law created regulations meant to prevent contamination of drinking water. Every 10 years, the city needs a waiver, so it doesn't have to build a filtration plant in upstate. In the early 90s, when they put a lot of the current regulations in place, that would have cost as much as $8 billion to build and as much as $500 million a year to maintain. Two of the city's reservoirs are in Delaware County. One, the Cannonsville Reservoir, is just outside Deposit. New York City has fought and clawed so that it, along with local governments and the DEC, is able to regulate in its watershed. That means if you live in Walton, you need a permit for stormwater plans from the city. You need a building permit from the city. You need a septic permit from the city. You can't take motorized boats on the reservoir. You need a permit to hike in their watershed. You can't log in their watershed. And the state has said it won't allow fracking in the watershed. All to protect New York City's drinking water. Decker says that's what happens when you let outsiders take over your land.
They really are handcuffing a lot of those towns up there where they can't industrialize. In all reality, that puts a control on the ability of the people up there to bring some kind of economy or something. It's a control on society where they become almost like obsolete bedroom communities or whatever.
And it's left a bitter taste in the mouths of many who live nearby.
This area provides very clean water for the city. And one reason why they're using water against this gas is they want to protect their water. They don't want to protect their water any more than what we do. My family lives right here. Our family is going to survive on this water that's right here. Well out there, and there's a well out here. There's my youngest son walking out there. And I went to Binghamton, I'm going to say a week or so ago, and I'm pretty sure you'll see it when you go to Binghamton. We counted 14 garbage trucks that's coming from the city. We send them down clean water. They send us up garbage.
No doubt about it, the watershed is an extreme example. The DEC's job is to create regulations that keep pollution below a certain level and fix it when it exceeds that level. The city of New York's job in the watershed is to make sure no pollution occurs. And when you drive into the watershed from Deposit, it is amazing how untouched everything looks. There are very few roads up into the hills above the reservoir. There are no houses in sight before you reach the town of Walton. The sound of jet skis and speedboats that are usually part of a body of water this large aren't found here. It's mostly just woods and birds for all of the 27-mile drive. And that's not something that people in Walton ever asked for. Dean Frazier works on watershed affairs in Delaware County. He's one of the many officials up here trying to create a fair relationship with the city.
So the community's changed. We're not as prosperous as we once were. A lot of businesses have left. What is hard to quantify is that business is coming in. And the city will argue maybe their regulations don't have that impact. But if I'm a business and I know I can set up shop outside the watershed in 6 months with less onerous regulations, but still got to comply with the state regulations versus coming here and going through the permitting process, not necessarily knowing whether or not I might be able to expand my business or make it grow easier in the watershed than outside the watershed, then there's not a lot of folks coming into the watershed to set up shop.
Frazier grew up in Walton. He was 10 years old when the reservoir was built. The building where we met in downtown Walton is a hive of activity. Like the town, the purpose of this building went from the dairy industry to small manufacturing to what it is today. Watershed Affairs.
This was originally a creamery. That went out, and Herbie Berger started this. They had almost 300 employees here pumping out contracts on wheel covers for a variety of different automobile companies here in the United States. That went out, and then early 90s, this program started up. And
the program he's referring to is city-funded farm management that works on runoff control and stream conservation. There are offices here for the United States Department of Agriculture, the County Soil and Water Conservation Program, and Watershed Affairs, among others. Frazier says that because the city can spend so much in the effort to keep from building a water filtration plant, they've created a model for environmentally sound farm management.
It's kind of unique. There wasn't anything else like it in the United States, and I don't think there is probably even today.
But when you walk through the town center, it's obvious that they've seen better days. I counted 15 empty storefronts along the four-block commercial strip. Part of that is because of flooding in 2006. Part of it is because there just isn't much new business coming to town. And in 2007, New York City started a land acquisition program. $300 million was pledged for the purchase of land and easements in the watershed. That program, combined with other pressures, to artificially drive up land prices, says Frazier.
For people that move here or build a new house, you're talking about a septic system that it's not unheard of to cost $30,000 or $35,000. So it's hard for young couples to, there's not a lot of job growth. When the city was really buying land, people were selling it, and the real estate market was really hot, the competition from the city drove the price of land up.
A 2009 study of the land acquisition program's likely economic effects painted a dire picture. They found that high-paying jobs in manufacturing and natural resources will remain stagnant or decline. Any increase in jobs is likely to be in the lower-paying tourism industry. The population is also likely to decrease because of rising land prices and the temptation of selling to the city. Frazier says the relationship between watershed towns and the city has gotten more cooperative after some pretty bad times. But now that the state is planning to ban hydrofracking, just in the watershed, there's a new example of outside control coming. And they're also asking for miles of buffers around the aqueducts that carry the water downstate.
They're proposing to control land outside the watershed, completely outside their municipal boundaries. That's just not fair. If you're going to do that, then there ought to be some kind of mitigation for the impact of that. Because they're literally would be controlling what can and cannot be done on lands that don't necessarily affect their water supply.
In years past, there was quite a bit of industry in this area.
Back in Deposit, fracking opponent Melissa Bishop continues her tour.
I have to go back quite a ways, but there was a glass factory, there was a seed factory, there was a sled factory, there was quite a bit of industry in deposits past.
I think a lot of people that support it say, you know, this is an industrial area. This is just the next wave.
What? Industrial area?
But you were just saying all these houses came here because of past industry.
Oh, past industry. Okay. And I'm going way past. Way, pretty far past. There was a decent amount of industry. Now there's like no industry. And I would certainly prefer to see the emphasis on ecotourism. That's what I would prefer.
In southern tier towns like Deposit or Elmira or Vestal or Horseheads, the debate about drilling is about what sort of places they will become. For decades, there's been a hole in the southern tier left by the legacy industries like IBM or the dairy business. The region hasn't recovered now that those businesses just don't employ many people here anymore. And a person like Bishop, who worked on Democratic Party campaigns in Long Island, who can be outspoken about her opinions, can seem like another outsider coming in to take over.
And I'm going to indulge in the small sausage gravy and biscuits.
Over breakfast in Deposit, Bishop talks about a group called Deposit Partners, modeled after a similar group started in nearby Hancock.
And it was basically, let me see, a group of businessmen, realtors, about six or seven people, who I think were frustrated with, let's say, the lack of progress at the local village level, municipal level, to get things done in Hancock. So they formed a group to utilize their combined resources to try and speed things up.
Part of the plan in both Deposit and Hancock is to actively market the area to downstate residents nearing retirement.
We're going to try and get, you know, people from downstate to perhaps rethink their very expensive and hustle-bustle lifestyle and trading it in for a lifestyle up here that is full of natural beauty.
I'd like to see landowners able to keep their land. I'd like to see that land stay intact. I like it to keep farming. To me, that's important. That's why I'm pro-gas.
It's a concern shared by many more than just Deposit resident Larry Schaefer. The land here is being lost to downstaters looking for second homes or a place to retire. And it turns out that it's not just a gradual process that's occurring naturally. In fact, there's an active campaign to entice them. Larry Schaefer would prefer if they just stayed downstate.
You know, even right now, over 80% of the people here in Deposit are absentee owners. They don't even live here. And they're building these trophy homes. They come up here with all the money they made at something else or in the city, and they come here to retire because it's a good move for them. The cost of living here is a lot less. This is Appalachia. People work cheap here. And that's very unfortunate. I'd like to raise that.
Is that a bad thing? If people want to retire rather than selling their land to people who will enjoy it rather than selling it to people who will destroy it?
And that's what it's come to in New York. People living in the same town, taking opposite sides of the issue, and seeing their side as the only way to save their community's way of life. There's a sense that once the DEC finishes its environmental review and lays out the regulations for fracking in New York, a deluge is coming. But that's not necessarily the case, says former Gannett reporter Tom Wilbur.
So you have to have the regulatory framework in place. That's very important. But there's several other factors that will determine the speed and pace of the shale gas rush.
First is the price of natural gas. If it remains low, drillers won't rush into New York. That's especially true if regulations are much stricter here than in Pennsylvania. Then there's the question of what will happen with the local bans. Lower court rulings upholding the rights of towns to ban drilling could create a complicated atmosphere for drilling, says Wilbur.
You know, you need the large contiguous area to develop shale gas. So if you have New York State that's broken up into various areas where all these municipalities are opting out, it's going to be a disincentive to drill in New York State.
And, of course, there's politics. Right now, the Democratic Party controls the Assembly and the Republicans at the State Senate. There is a chance that could change in November and the Democrats could take the Senate. It's not the likely outcome, but a possibility.
And if you have Democrats in both, then you have the real likely scenario, or at least a very possible scenario, that they could pass some legislation that would be a big disincentive to drill in New York.
Finally, environmental groups probably won't give up the fight. The lack of a public health study in the state's environmental review could put the issue in the courts for a long time. The designation of drilling wastewater as an industrial waste instead of hazardous waste, has also drawn criticism from environmentalists. Thrown a governor who's widely believed to have presidential aspirations, the national elections in November that could lead to federal regulation of fracking, and put it all together, and it could still be years before it comes to New York State. But no matter what happens before the end of this year, the debate over fracking in New York is far from over. In Binghamton, I'm Matt Richmond for InnovationTrail.org.